From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what happens when 1,600 influential people meet on Mackinac Island?
It fosters, in a way, some intellectual tension that make us all reach for better.
How Kalamazoo supports its homeless students.
Our homeless children are dealing with a swirl of challenges at home. And what we try to do is to make school their shelter in a storm.
The best school slam poetry team in Michigan.
You kind of like help each other and you help yourselves. So the cockiness is like, you got to get rid of it.
And Star Wars comes to the DIA.
When they opened the crate for R2-D2, I have to confess that even though I've never been all that sentimental about the character, I teared up.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Black residents in Grand Rapids have long thought the city's police targeted them unfairly. But a traffic study released last year put some data behind those decades-old beliefs. Michigan Radio's Bryce Huffman reports what residents in the department think has changed since that study was released.
This is the intersection of Kalamazoo Street and Burton in Grand Rapids. It's a windy day in this predominantly black neighborhood on the southeast side of the city. A few pedestrians make their way to the bus stop next to the mobile gas station on the corner. 4 years ago, Elaine Howell was on her way to work at Meijer. It was in the early hours of the morning, so it was still dark out. She noticed a police car following her as she approached this intersection.
Officer, and I said to myself, get ready because I know he's going to stop me.
Howell kept driving with the police car behind her for about a mile. Once she pulled into the Meijer parking lot on 28th Street, she saw flashing lights.
My heart started racing, and I said, hey, you didn't do anything wrong. I kept my hands on the steering wheel. I didn't reach for anything. I let them instruct me.
Her fear was heightened by what she saw next.
When he approached my car, he also had his hand on his gun.
The officer gave her a speeding ticket, but it was later voided after police looked at traffic cam footage that showed she was actually going below the speed limit. Howell made it out of that situation without any physical harm, but her trust in the Grand Rapids police might be forever lost. And she's not alone in that mistrust. Black residents have long criticized the department for questionable stops just like this. Last year, a traffic study showed that between 2013 and 2015, black drivers were twice as likely to be stopped by police as their white counterparts. The department started getting more intentional with implicit bias training for its officers, making sure to really examine why officers make the choices they make when dealing with civilians. It's only been a year since the ball got rolling on this. The city's chief of police, David Rahinsky, acknowledges that residents might not see a big change quite yet.
It's an ongoing effort. It's not a one and done. There's not a magic potion for these types of issues, but this is a great community. It's a great police department, and I have no doubt that collectively we'll get to where we want to be.
The department has an outside consulting firm looking through the policies and procedures officers follow. They're trying to ensure that there aren't any disparate outcomes for any particular group of people. But some residents are skeptical. LaDonna Norman is a black woman who frequents public meetings to discuss issues like police bias. Norman was stopped by police back in January. She says everything about the stop was odd.
It got to the point where I'm about to have an anxiety attack. I'm not feeling well. I'm anxious. And the police have me pulled over and they're questioning my identity.
She says police stopped her for not using a turn signal, but for some reason they started asking questions about her twin sister. Norman wasn't ticketed and she wasn't physically harmed, but her idea of the city's police was further soured. Norman thinks the police department is inherently racist and that no amount of training or community meetings will change that.
They're trying to rebuild something that was systematically set up for us to fail.
I walked around predominantly black neighborhoods in Grand Rapids for hours at a time to ask people what they thought of the city's police. We can't play most of their responses on air, but there were a lot of four-letter words used. We can, however, share one response that came from a man named Darian Colbert. He's a Grand Rapids native who thinks that black residents have been pushed around for too long.
We ain't gonna wait forever, you know. Eventually, it's gonna get to a breaking point. Everything do, you know. When you oppress people, they rise up in a fiery anger.
So the Grand Rapids Police Department has two jobs ahead. The first is acknowledging and fixing any bias in how it polices black neighborhoods. The second, which might be even harder, is building trust with black residents. I'm Bryce Huffman.
And as we just heard, since 2015, the entire Grand Rapids Police Department underwent racial bias training. So we wondered, has anything improved for black drivers in Grand Rapids? Michigan Radio's Kay LaFond looked at data for 2017. Kay, what made you want to dive into this data?
Well, you know, there's a long history of tension in Grand Rapids between the community and the police. And in early 2017, there was a study that came out, and the results of that study showed that black drivers are twice as likely to be stopped. So there is definitely a problem happening. But it only looked at the years 2013 through 2015. But we thought, you know, that study came out, and we also knew that there was a police bias training in 2016. And the study came out in early 2017. So hypothetically, you know, 2017 should have been better. You had a study done. Mm-hmm. You had this bias training that had already taken place. But the anecdotes didn't look good. We had an incident with, you know, multiple unarmed black kids handcuffed and put in cop cars after mm-hmm. a phone call. And that was just a couple weeks before the study was released. And then later that year in December, there was an 11-year-old black girl held at gunpoint. And we thought, you know, what gives? Has anything changed? I wanted to answer that question with data.
All right. So you dive into the data. What'd you find? Have things gotten better?
Well, it's really, really hard to tell. Long story short. I mean, police data can be misinterpreted really easily. We thought we had some things at first, but then we ran them by an expert, Dr. Michael Smith. He's chair of the Criminal Justice Department at UT San Antonio. And he told me that we were misinterpreting some things, and it's really hard to find, you know, evidence of bias in data.
So he kind of just basically poked holes in everything that you thought you'd found?
Pretty much. And, you know, he had seen other newsrooms making this same mistake, and he talked about seeing other newsrooms kind of go on to publish those findings without, you know, adding any of the important context. And he thought, you know, sometimes people are misleading their readers. So
and statistics are complicated.
Yeah.
So give us an example of this.
So we know that the city of Grand Rapids is about 20% black. And we looked at the overall pool of traffic stops, and we saw that black motorists accounted for about 40% of the stops in both 2016 and 2017. So on the surface, that sounds like, okay, you've got, you know, a disproportionate number of black motorists being stopped compared to the population. And also, it didn't get better in 2017, seemingly.
Yeah, you could think that.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a couple of problems with this. The first is that to really prove a bias, you have to compare stops to the driving population, which is not the same as the general population. You know, people aren't always working, shopping, or going to school where they're living. Not everybody has a driver's license. Mm. And there's just so many other things. And research has shown that the general population, you know, what the numbers you get from the census data just can't stand in for the driving population.
That's a good way to look at it. What's the second problem?
The second problem is that if you're looking at stops on a citywide basis, you're missing local policing patterns. So mm-hmm. it could be that police spend more time in black neighborhoods. And if that's the case, you know, maybe that's a problem in and of itself. But it doesn't show that police are picking more black motorists out of traffic. It's just that they're spending more time where more of the drivers are black.
Got that. But there was this study done looking at the years 2013 through 2015 that did show bias, correct? So how did they do it?
Yeah. So to deal with these issues, the consultant who did the study, they had to basically pick 20 intersections in the city. And then at each intersection, they had to go out and count the cars and the race of the drivers in the cars at each one. And then at each intersection, they could estimate what, you know, portion of the motorists driving through there are black.
Okay.
Then you compare that to the city's data on the traffic stops at that particular intersection. So, for example, at the intersection of Bridge and Stocking, black drivers made up 15%. But in 2015, you know, they made up 30% of the traffic stops. So that's evidence of bias. You've got, you know, twice mm-hmm. as many
people being stopped
percentage-wise yes. as there are, you know, in the population. So, you know, that is something that can give you a clear answer, yes, at this intersection there's a problem. Unfortunately for us, the data that we have and that we were looking at, it wasn't referenced to, you know, individual intersections, so we couldn't calculate stop statistics for 2017 at that same local level, and we couldn't really make a comparison.
Okay. Yeah, you also looked at searches, didn't you?
We did. And we looked at searches for the city overall. And, you know, this is a little better because we can at least say, okay, once the motorists are stopped, we can see that 6% of you know, the black motorists who were stopped, they were then searched at the officer's discretion. And that's down from 2013 when it was at 10%, but it's no different than in 2016. And it's about twice the rate at which white drivers are stopped. So
that kind of sounds like there really wasn't any improvement from 2016 to 2017.
Right. And Dr. Smith told us, you know, those numbers are a good first step and that they're, you know, kind of suggestive. But we are missing another piece, and that's something called a hit rate. So the hit rate is the rate at which different racial groups are actually found with illegal items when they're searched. So some police departments have argued that different search rates are defensible if one racial group is found with contraband more often.
Okay, this sounds controversial.
It is controversial, and not everybody, you know, agrees that that's an appropriate justification. But regardless, most studies on a broad basis have found that black motorists are actually found with illegal items less often than white motorists.
Hmm.
And the consulting firm looking at Grand Rapids found that in Grand Rapids, black motorists are no more likely to have illegal items with them. But we didn't have data on hit rates for 2016 or 2017. So again, couldn't draw a direct comparison.
All right. So there's one more hole punched in that. Now, you looked at stop reasons too.
Yeah. And this one wasn't really like a comparison between years. We weren't really looking at any kind of difference or change over time. We were just curious. And we pooled all the data we had from 2013 to 2017. And we found some pretty interesting patterns, mainly that the leading stop reasons for black drivers and white drivers were different.
How so?
Well, white drivers are most commonly stopped because of a moving violation. So some kind of traffic infraction, you know, you're doing something wrong on the road. But black drivers are most commonly stopped because of equipment violations. So that includes things like missing license plates and broken brake lights. But we don't know what that means. It could be that cops are targeting black drivers using equipment violations, or it could be socioeconomic. It could be that black drivers are having more trouble affording new brake lights, or it could be a combination. We can say stop reasons are different between the groups, but we really can't put our finger on why.
So from all of this, what do you think the main takeaway is, Kay?
Well, I want to make it clear that we aren't saying there isn't a problem in Grand Rapids. You know, that study that was done, it was high quality, it was professional analysis of the data, and they found clear evidence of bias. What we are saying is that it's really hard to recreate that with the kind of data you can get your hands on as a news person. And I think a lot of newsrooms around the country right now are, you know, trying to do something similar. They're trying to get this police data. And, you know, they should make sure that they're putting their findings into proper context.
Digging into the statistics and doing it right.
Yes.
Very good. Michigan Radio's Kayla Fahn, thank you so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When audiences first heard the trumpet fanfare of John Williams' theme for Star Wars, it was 1977, and it was a jolt of pure movie magic. And all these years later, the magic is still there. Star Wars still holds a Darth Vader-like grip on our imagination. The Detroit Institute of Arts is tapping into that magic with its newest exhibit. Star Wars and the Power of Costume runs now through September 30th at the DIA. With us now is Elliot Wilhelm, curator of the exhibition, also the film curator of the Detroit Film Theater at the DIA. Elliot, good to have you with us.
It's great to be with you, Cynthia.
And Elliot, you've been quoted as saying that this is a timeless exhibition. Why so?
Well, it has to do not just with Star Wars, but with the power of cinema. Making a movie is just one of those unimaginable tasks. It takes hundreds of people all working in coordination on different aspects of creating what ultimately turns out to be a singular vision. And we go and we spend our 90 minutes or 2 hours watching it. And we don't really question how it happened. It's just kind of by magic. We know there's a director someplace. But there are so many different craftspeople, so many different artists who have ideas and also add their vision to a production. We have, along with the Smithsonian Institution's traveling exhibitions and with the Lucas Museum of Narrative Art, been able to mount an exhibition on one aspect of filmmaking, one that people don't always pay attention to other than perhaps subliminally, and that is costume. So it could be an exhibition about costumes for any film, any classic film that people have grown to know and love, but there's something spectacular about the various costumes in Star Wars, which becomes apparent the instant you walk into the exhibition or the instant you look at any one of the films.
Give us an idea of some of the costumes. I know you've got over 60 original costumes from those first seven Star Wars films. Give us an idea of some of the ones that are just going to really hit people.
Well, there's what we are now referring to as an unofficial selfie station, which is a spot where people are so knocked out by the two costumes next to each other, one of them being the original Chewbacca. He's an imposing figure. He's a very tall fellow, and he's covered in yak hair, and he's just splendid. And standing next to him is Han Solo. And we see Han Solo's vest and his gun belt, which contains a blaster. Next to that is an image from High Noon with Gary Cooper. And you might say, what's this doing here? But we're making connections between the characters that people have come to know and love. Even if they weren't science fiction fans, they understood the role in this adventure that a sort of roguish person like Han Solo and his sidekick, Chewbacca, were playing. We've seen it before. We've seen it in Westerns. We've seen it in other kinds of adventure films. And yet, when you walk into the gallery of droids that's part of the exhibition, when we look at R2-D2, a lot of folks might not consider him or think of him as a costume. And yet, there was a small person, an actor by the name of Kenny Baker, mm-hmm. who was inside of R2-D2, who helped him sort of scuttle along in scenes when that was necessary. And being in a room with the original R2-D2, which this one is, and seeing the original concept drawings to see the evolution of this character, what it was once conceived would be a perfect little droid to have in the film, and how he evolved and why he evolved because of technological issues, it's fascinating for anyone who is either into Star Wars or is simply wanting to know about how these movies get made, how any movie gets made.
Appreciating good design and then realizing what this series of films did to push the envelope for movie making, and what we see today wouldn't have happened had George Lucas not pushed that envelope back in 77 and beyond.
Absolutely true. I mean, he was always fascinated by science fiction films and fantasy films, and among his favorites, for example, he lists it now as his number one favorite film, was a 1927 German silent film by the director Fritz Lang called Metropolis, mm-hmm. which was a huge epic science fiction movie about the division between the sort of imperialist classes and the workers and a revolution that results in the future. But one of the elements of Metropolis is a robot created by a mad scientist. And Lucas always loved this robot, but it was a female robot, very sleek, very beautifully designed. And when it came time to create C-3PO for Star Wars, Lucas reached back into the films that he loved and told his design folks, I want C-3PO to be based on the Fritz Lang robot from 1927, but obviously not be the same. I want it to be humanoid, but to have that kind of futuristic, beautiful, gleaming quality.
You know, this Smithsonian exhibition, I know it's been touring around the U.S. for the past 3 years, so this is the final stop. The Travel Channel put it on its list of 10 art exhibits worth traveling for in 2018. Elliot, why was Detroit and the DIA a good fit for this exhibition as you landed it?
Since this building went up in 1927, Cynthia, when it first opened its doors, the theater where we run films now every weekend and where so many other kinds of events take place, that theater was equipped for film from 1927, from opening day, and had a projection booth in it, as it still does. We showed film as an art form right from the very beginning, actually predating the Museum of Modern Art in New York by about 3 months, I think. So in some ways, we're the first North American museum to take cinema really seriously as one of the arts, and we still do. So it only makes sense. We look at and examine cinema as an art form, and being an art form that's different from the others. It's not just a mashup of sculpture and painting. It is something unique. It is something wholly other. And our director, Salvador Salvador, in order to sort of make a statement about that, saw that the really joyous and informative open qualities of this exhibition would be a perfect way to introduce the cinema into the regular galleries here at the DIA and to bring in audiences who may never have visited the museum. And in fact, the exhibition makes connections between many of the other arts that we have and specific works that we have at the DIA. Darth Vader's helmet is clearly based on a samurai helmet design, and we have one in our collection. So there are connections between films, there are connections between works of art, but most of all, we want to establish a connection with the people who may feel that this institution is not for them and point out to them quite simply that it's just the contrary. It's for everyone.
So we've got more than 60 original costumes, 150 plus pieces of artwork and videos and sketches that tell the story behind the movies. But you're also tying in film screenings as well?
Yes. During the summer, beginning in June, we're going to be having on most days that we're open at 3 p.m. films that are free with museum admission. Kind of the films that inspired in some way or another Star Wars. Some of those specifically described by Lucas as inspirations for certain aspects of Star Wars. For example, a Japanese film by Akira Kurosawa called The Hidden Fortress, which has virtually the same plot and the same major characters as Star Wars. It was made in the 1950s. But also a lot of adventure films. I mean, after all, Star Wars is kind of a swashbuckler set in space. And there are Earthbound swashbucklers that inspired Lucas also, films like The Adventures of Robin Hood and The Seahawk with Errol Flynn, and of course lots of science fiction from the 1950s and the early 1960s, movies like Journey to the Center of the Earth and This Island Earth, Creature from the Black Lagoon, you name it. We have more than 40 plus films that we're going to be running during June, July, and August for people to just drop in on when they come to see the Star Wars exhibition.
Well, Star Wars and the Power of Costume runs now through September 30th at the DIA, and you can get all the information and tickets by going to DIA.org. One final question, Elliot. You were there the day the first Star Wars movie opened. You were at the Americana Cinema in 1977. How'd you feel when the first crate got opened and you, like, beheld Chewbacca?
I didn't think this would happen to me, honestly, because I've been working with movies and meeting movie people, and I even had a bit part in an actual Hollywood film and considered myself kind of jaded. But when they opened the crate for R2-D2, I have to confess that even though I've never been all that sentimental about the character, I teared up. And I thought, you know, I love movies, and it became a very emotional moment for me. And I was really, really happy at that moment that we were doing this exhibition and that I got to be a part of it, to have, I'm hoping, other movie lovers experience that same kind of connection and that same kind of emotion.
Elliot Wilhelm with the DIA, may the force be with you. Thank you.
And you as well, Cynthia. Thanks.
Turning now to slam poetry. Arts Academy in the Woods is a fine and performing arts magnet school in Fraser in Macomb County. This year, its poetry slam team won first place at the statewide poetry slam competition. Louder Than a Bomb, the Michigan Youth Poetry Festival, is the largest gathering of young writers in Michigan.
I had my first kiss underneath the weathered bleachers of a DPS high
school. I married my
lover
on the cracking steps of the Baptist church my mama
raised
me in.
I played hide and go seek in the rubble of abandoned architecture.
I dodged bullies on the playground just as often as bullets.
I swam in DIY kiddie pools created by broken fire hydrants.
I taught my siblings their wrong from right and how to read and write.
I lived a life. Welcome to my projects, where our crowns are crooked
and our tiaras are bent.
Where safety and fathers were not always present, but love was. Welcome to the Hood Dictionary, where we must consistently redefine royalty.
That was Sierra Dozier, along with Rebecca Kahn, James Scarborough, and Kyle Starks, all members of the Arts Academy in the Woods Slam Team. And I'm joined now by two of the students, Sierra and James, and their slam poetry coach and creative writing teacher, Craig Campbell. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for
Great
having
to be
us.
Here.
Let's start just to get an understanding, Craig. Tell us a little more about Arts Academy in the Woods and its students.
It's a magnet school in Macomb. It serves lots of different kind of artists. There's dancers. Sierra's a dancer as well, right? And vocalists. James is also a vocalist, visual artists. And just we have a focus on the arts. We have, you know, great literacy scores. And what's incredible as a teacher is that there's so much talent. And we have biweekly assemblies, and you get to see these kids perform. And it inspires you as a teacher. You want to do your best because they're all good at something.
All right, so you have a team. How many on the team?
There's 8 competing poets on the team.
And you brought some heavy hitters
today.
And how many teams
did they beat out to win the statewide competition?
There was 20 teams down there. I think there were 14 competing teams this year.
That had to be a really proud moment for everybody to wind
absolutely
up becoming best.
It was our third year, and Sierra's been with me every year. It's her senior year, and we were delighted to get the win in her last year at Arts Academy.
So how diverse is the student body, James, as a student? Give me your perspective.
It's super diverse. You have a bunch of different personality types, different races, different upbringings, and it's kind of a learning experience, so you can see how different people respond to different things and try to, you know, vibe with them and try to understand them more.
What has that exposure to diversity meant for your singing, for your poetry writing?
It's broadened my horizons a lot. When you see a bunch of different personalities and a bunch of different mindsets, you kind of have to expand yours. There's really nothing else you can do. Your mind becomes more open.
And what grade are you in now?
I'm a 10th grader.
So you're 10th grader. So you've still got a couple more years to really get in there. And what about you, Sierra?
I am in the 12th grade. So 4 years at Arts Academy.
And why did you join the Poetry Slam team?
Well, I wrote my first slam poem in the 10th grade. So freshman year, I was taking choir because I thought I could sing, but I really couldn't. So then I started writing in creative writing. I wrote my first slam poem, and then that was just a little competition. It wasn't really like we weren't going a lot on the bomb then, but then Mr. Campbell came. He like, okay, so I'm taking the 10 first place poets to that competition a lot on the bomb, and that's when it all started.
It all started. How about you? When did you write your first slam poem?
Probably this year, to be honest. I've always like wrote poetry, but not slam poetry.
And so for those of us who don't know the difference, explain that for us.
Slam poetry is more of you have like a central idea and you kind of like expound on it, try to like get a point across. But certain poetry, there's like really no limits to it. You could basically write about anything and you kind of just like use like a bunch of figurative language.
All right, James, well, you wrote the winning group piece. Tell us, what's the title? What's it about?
The poem's called Welcome to the Projects, and it's basically about, like, a small piece of the Black experience for some people. And I wrote it because, you know, going to a diverse school, there's many different diverse backgrounds. So basically, it was kind of me, like, teaching the audience about what I went through and stuff about me so they could relate to me as I try to relate to them.
All right, let's take a listen.
Y'all said we were Black kings, but royalty ain't never had to beg for its next meal.
Y'all convinced me that I catered to some form of magic that only Black men and women hold at their fingertips.
But where the hell is it?
No fairy godmother is fluttering her iridescent wings and reviving my 7 mile homies.
No wizard is waving his wand in a sophisticated pattern to fix y'all outdated mindsets.
The only real magic is my family, disappearing off these streets like the tax forms and emails of crooked politicians.
Welcome to the projects.
Here you won't find princes or emperors, but you see thugs and wannabe gangsters in eerie abundance.
We can't afford princesses or queens, so we rely on the backbones of baby mamas and single mothers.
We put them on pedestals, adorn them in scented rose petals, and wrap their bones in warmth.
You won't find your sheltered suburban two-parent household.
You'll find struggle, sisters with nothing but a part-time job, a dream, and a cesspool of odds stacked like bricks against them.
You'll discover R&B girls and hip-hop boys singing and rapping for their lives, earning their way out.
Mixtape after mixtape, harmony after harmony.
You won't see none of that unseasoned chicken, sugarless oatmeal or green bean casserole. We got southern cooking, cornbread, baked mac and cheese, spicy kind of lives.
We got passerbys, white teens flexing Jags and Royces, blasting Black rappers from their radios, screaming racial slurs from the comfort of their tinted windows.
We surrounded by chaos,
locked in a never-ending battle with bloodthirsty creatures.
Craig, speaking as their creative writing teacher and as their coach, what does this team and their win in the statewide competition, what does it tell us about the power of poetry?
The beauty of it is, you know, they get to express themselves, but they're empowered, they feel good about themselves, and they make friends down there, lifelong friends sometimes. And on our way over here, you guys ran into somebody from Louder Than a Bomb, and it was like, you know, they'd all been through this experience together.
Did you guys, either one of you, James or Sierra, did you know you could write poetry until kind of getting pulled into this? I know you said you'd been doing some poetry.
Well, I never really knew what slam poetry was. So I could write poetry. I wrote page poems all the time. But like I didn't know I could write slam poetry until we watched the film Louder Than a Bomb. It's on Netflix. And we watched that and I was like, oh, I think I can do that. So that's when I like tried it, and it actually didn't turn out that bad. It was basically like
slam poetry or spoken word is basically just like talking, but sometimes it rhymes.
And there's collaboration. There's a team. So it's not just a person doing their own thing. What did you learn about this idea of, okay, there's a bunch of us and we want to work together as one?
You just have to really humble yourself. Like, you don't go into the practices or the meetings thinking, oh, I'm the best poet on this team, I don't need practice, because we all have things we could work on, we all have performance things that we could fix. So you kind of like help each other and you help yourselves. So the cockiness is like, you got to get rid of it.
Check that ego back at the door before you walk in there. Well, congratulations to Sierra Dozier and James Scarborough and their coach and teacher, Craig Campbell, and other members of the Arts Academy in the Woods Poetry Slam team, Rebecca Kahn and Kyle Starks, winning first place at the recent statewide Poetry Slam competition at Louder Than a Bomb, the Michigan Youth Poetry Festival. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll check in with Kalamazoo Public Schools, the district reporting the most homeless students in Michigan.
Our young people don't leave that challenge, that stress, that anxiety at home.
And then we head up north for day one of the Mackinac Policy Conference. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A recent University of Michigan study dug into the issue of homeless students. Researchers from the U of M Poverty Solutions Initiative found Michigan has one of the biggest populations of homeless students in the nation. Topping the list of districts that report the largest number of homeless students, Kalamazoo, the 13th largest district in the state. Let's see what this means for the district as we welcome Kalamazoo Superintendent Dr. Michael Rice. Dr. Rice, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Cynthia. Good to be on the show.
So the University of Michigan study that was released last month showed your district's reporting 904 homeless students. Is that number in the ballpark? Is that correct?
That's right.
So are these students spread throughout your district, or do they mainly attend certain schools?
Well, we have 26 schools in the district, and we're a district of approximately 13,000 students. And we're up in all academic indicators, reading, writing, math, advanced placement percentage, and graduation rates. Our kids are children of poverty, are distributed across the district, and our homeless children are distributed across the district. It's true that there are greater percentages at particular schools, but we have children that have struggled with homelessness at all of our 26 schools in the district. Oftentimes, people think of Kalamazoo through the lens of Western Michigan University or Kalamazoo College, or through the lens of the Kalamazoo Promise, free college tuition for graduating from high school. And we were fortunate enough to have the president visit us 8 years ago for our work in creating a college-going culture in Kalamazoo. That said, we have very, very high poverty in Kalamazoo. Of the 13 largest districts in the state, our poverty is top three among those 13 largest districts. Detroit, Grand Rapids, and KPS are the three highest poverty. Our percentage, free and reduced price lunch eligible, is not top three. As a result, and all else being equal, it's not surprising that our homelessness rate would be top three in the state. I have my questions about Detroit's number. I find it difficult to believe that a district that's almost four times as big as KPS doesn't have more homeless children than we do. I suspect that there are counting issues.
Yeah, that number was, just for everybody's reference, was reported in as 605.
Correct.
Yes.
And so, you know, it was a third lower than ours. I think our number is a legitimate number. It's consistent with numbers that we've had over the last decade and a half. The number has varied. Certainly it was greater during the Great Recession than it is now. It's dropped off some. But it's still not as low as it was when I came to the district in 2007. It spiked in 08 and 09 and 10 and dropped down a little bit thereafter.
So give us an idea. What is school like on a day-to-day basis for these children who have to deal with homelessness? I'm wondering kind of what extra barriers do they face in going to school and in doing their classwork?
Our homeless children are dealing with a swirl of challenges at home. And what we try to do is to make school their shelter in a storm. We have a series of magnet schools in the district to which any child in the district can attend, number one. We provide transportation to these magnet schools, irrespective of where you live, number two. So if you have a very transient or mobile home situation, we share with you opportunities to stay put in school. We have Communities and Schools of Kalamazoo, a 501c3 organization in 20 of our 26 schools, and that 501c3 provides or coordinates a range of services available to our young people. We have 200-plus community partnerships. Loaves and Fishes is a food pantry in town. Loaves and Fishes, over the last few years, has established 8 food pantries in our schools, is working on establishing a 9th food pantry. We're trying to figure out how to create pantries in every one of our schools where there are children of need. These are pantries where parents can come.
Certainly one of the recommendations that came out of that University of Michigan study is develop community partnerships with local schools. So it seems that's certainly an approach you're taking in Kalamazoo.
There's no question about that. I will tell you that we've done a few other things beyond what I just mentioned. We established a mentoring program in the district 2.5 years ago. I challenged our male staff members to mentor 5 young people a week, 5-on-1 mentoring, a lunch a week. In the second year, we extended to our female staff, mentoring female students, and we also extended into the community to get community mentors. Mentoring is designed to focus on the individual child, the individual strengths and weaknesses, needs of, interests of, little Michael Rice or little Cynthia Canty, and all that he or she is going through in his or her life.
And as you describe the community efforts and all of this work, mentoring with teachers and administrators, with students, are you seeing that impact their graduation rate? Because we certainly know in that study from the University of Michigan supports that students facing homelessness in this state are at a far bigger risk of not finishing high school. Are you seeing that impact graduation rates?
Our graduation rate has gone up 10 percentage points since 2010. So our graduation rate rose 10 percentage points from 2010 to 2017. We've got a long way to go before we're where we need to be, but you're clearly seeing the right trajectory. And the way to make the most significant movement on those sorts of indicators is to work with your children with the greatest need, whose achievement is in many cases the lowest because of all they're fighting through.
Are the homeless students on that same upward trajectory? Where are they in all of this?
So you know what? We do not track homeless student graduation rate per se, but I can tell you that our graduation rate for economically disadvantaged children is up, for African American children is up, African American males up. So, you know, typically the socioeconomic disadvantage or the economic disadvantage and homelessness run hand in glove. Clearly there are more children who are free or reduced price lunch eligible than there are children who are homeless in the district. But if you're making an impact on the one, you tend to be making an impact on the other.
What kind of stress does having these 904 homeless students, what kind of stress does that put on your district?
Look, imagine the stress it puts on our children.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine the stress that it puts on their families. Our young people don't leave that challenge, that stress, that anxiety at home. It travels with them. Now, they may be able to get some respite at school from it, but the idea that they can wall off or compartmentalize the challenges in their home lives while they're at school, I think, is pretty unrealistic. I think the stress and challenge is on our young people, and I think it extends to those who work with our young people, our teachers, our support staff, our administrators, and our like, and by extension, those in the nonprofit community that support our children and families, and by extension, our schools as well.
What more do you think can be done, not only within your district, Dr. Rice, in Kalamazoo, but throughout Michigan to help these students, these children of poverty, and these children who are battling the challenges of being homeless? Because succeeding in school is the thing they need to break that poverty cycle.
At the individual school district level, we've begun to do professional development in what's called ACEs training, Adverse Childhood Experiences training. It's also sometimes referred to as trauma-informed care, professional development. This is getting a sense of the trauma that a number of our young people face as a function of their adverse childhood experiences, and getting a sense of how to address young people who have had these or who are currently having these adverse childhood experiences, these so-called ACEs. So that, I think, is very, very important. I think any school district that deals with significant numbers of young people with homelessness or other adverse childhood experiences needs this training, not as a way of excuse making, but as a way of understanding better the young people whom they serve and the families that they serve. At the university level, I think our young people coming out of teacher ed programs need to better understand trauma-informed care, need to better understand poverty, and particularly urban poverty, and particularly our urban young people, whether they're poor or working class or not. There's a different rhythm in our urban jurisdictions, and I think our schools of education need to teach our teacher ed candidates a little bit more about urban youth, that they need to experience urban youth to a greater extent before they become teachers in front of classrooms of 30 to 1. At the state and the federal level, particularly at the state level where the vast majority of our resources come, we are underfunded. And when you look at the number of nurses, the number of social workers, the number of psychologists, psychiatrists, the number of mental health therapists, the wraparound services that we have for our young people, the counselor, student-teacher ratios, you can see repeatedly that there are not enough resources to do the job, particularly with children with profound challenges, particularly with children who are homeless.
Kalamazoo Superintendent Dr. Michael Rice with insights on helping children of poverty and students who are homeless within the Kalamazoo Public Schools. Thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside, Dr. Rice.
I appreciate it, Cynthia.
And this note, while Kalamazoo Public Schools does not track the graduation rate for its homeless students, the U of M study found homeless students across the state have the lowest four-year graduation rate of any group for which data is available. And the study found while dropout rates have gone down for economically disadvantaged students and other groups across Michigan, dropout rates for homeless students have gone up. Michigan's 2018 Mackinac Policy Conference kicks off today. Big names in politics, business, philanthropy, tech, education, and more will be on the island for the annual conference that's put on by the Detroit Regional Chamber. Here with us now from Mackinac Island is businessman and GOP fundraiser John Bricolta Jr. What are your personal goals for this conference?
Well, I think that this conference provides individuals like myself the opportunity to continue to build bridges, renew old relationships, perhaps form some new ones. In fact, it's the best networking conference in the entire state of Michigan, if not the United States. I mean, rarely can you get 1,600 people from all walks of life, community influencers, philanthropy, captains of industry, labor, education, health, the list goes on and on and on, all together and in some ways trapped where they can't sneak off and have some really meaningful dialogue on the policies that are affecting our lives on a daily basis and those who want to try to make Michigan a better place to live and work.
When you think about what's ahead for these few days, what is not on the agenda that you wish had gotten there?
I don't know. I think what's on the agenda is perfect. You know, we're going to be talking about the workforce, shortage of talent, how a disruption is occurring at such a rapid rate today, the fact that many companies are in search of this workforce for the future, and the shortages we need to overcome. I can't think of a more meaningful and impactful agenda.
And as you say, people are there together. Nobody can really sneak away. You're on that island. And I would imagine there are folks talking who might not normally do so.
Well, look, that's the whole idea of this conference, and quite frankly, Michigan needs to get a whole lot better at how we communicate with each other. Having that collaboration is vitally important to develop the cohesion that's needed to compete in the world today. You can't innovate on your own any longer. Science has made our lives all too complicated. Policy making is in many respects similar to making sausage. There's a lot of ingredients that go in, and there ultimately needs to be some compromise at the end of all those discussions. And I find that this 3 days really shapes my thinking. It tests the positions that I'm taking. It fosters, in a way, some intellectual tension that make us all reach for better. And in the end, it's the bedrock of compromise and ultimate agreement. And look, the world is an enormously large place, but it's also very complicated and it's very, very competitive. And in order for Michigan to continue to march forward, we've got to find solutions to these problems that we're facing.
One of the problems that has played a role in discussions at Mackinac through the years has been Detroit education. And you have really, John Ricolta, taken a real leadership role in Detroit education through the years. Do you feel like the city schools are on track or getting on track?
I do. I believe we've turned the corner. We've reached the bottom and we've started to come out. In 2016, we were fortunate to have the opportunity to work on this and also to get the legislature and the governor on board. And we came away with a significant number of wins. We eliminated the debt. We closed the EAA, which was very unpopular in the city of Detroit. We elected a new school board, and they in turn elected a phenomenal superintendent who has an incredible track record of turning poorly performing school districts around. His most recent success was in Jacksonville, Florida. So 2016 was sort of the turning point, and I think our society has recognized the need for us to do a whole lot better. And both the coalition and BLM and the state have realized we've got a long way to go in order to catch up and get ahead. There's an enormous amount of work that's been done over the past year and more to be done. The coalition has taken a look inside and has come out with a 6-point plan that they have published extensively on and working very hard on it. And BLM has gathered a large number of businesses and have also produced a report that outlines 5 principles on which they need to work on going forward. So I'm very, very encouraged that we're getting to that tipping point where we recognize that this is the salient and number one issue that's going to drive the future for Michigan. If we can't educate our kids and get them to stay here, we're going to have big problems in the future.
And we should note for everybody's clarification, when you talk about BLM, we're talking about the group Business Leaders for Michigan, because there are a couple of BLMs out there. But yes, so it's Business Leaders for Michigan. Do you feel like you've gotten the support you need from the Trump administration, from Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, to get Detroit schools back on track?
I'm not looking to the federal government for help. I think this is something we've got to fix as a state. You know, we've got to come together in this state. We have a state board of education. You know, we've got a terrific legislature and Senate. We have a governor who's committed to new principles. He calls it the Marshall Plan. And we've got to do it here first. And then once we're able to all come together, we can then march off to Washington and ask for those couple of other things that'll put us over the top. But no, I don't think this is a federal issue. I think this is a state and local issue, and we've got to find a way to fix it.
John, what do you feel in the time that you've been involved with the Mackinac Policy Conference, what have been the big accomplishments that have really made a difference in the everyday lives of people in Michigan?
Well, it's brought a lot of people together that normally wouldn't be talking to each other in an environment that fosters great, great conversation, lays out positions, and sets an agenda going forward that we can work on for the next year. And now, that's not the only policy conference, and there are others that do terrific work, but that's the whole point of a policy conference, is to, you know, get an agenda set, compromise, agree on that agenda, and then go out and try to make it happen. And one case in point is the debt for the Detroit Public Schools, which was approaching $600 million. We won't get into who caused it, but it was at the conference 2 years ago that everything came together that allowed a solution to come forward. And that saved the Detroit public school system and improved the education for 45,000 kids.
John Ricolt is speaking to us from Mackinac Island, where the 2018 Mackinac Policy Conference is kicking off today. John, thanks so much for spending time with us.
Happy to do so.
That's our show. Thank you so much for listening.